I'm going to turn the meeting over now to Ms. Susie M. She's going to chair our LMI meeting. Thank you. Al-Anon, member of the Al-Anon family. Do you join me in the serenity prayer, please? Serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Okay, I'm going to read the Al-Anon opening. We welcome you to the Al-Anon family group. Hope you will find in this fellowship the help and friendship we have been privileged to enjoy. We who live or have lived with the problem of alcoholism understand as perhaps few others can. We too were lonely and frustrated, but in Al-Anon we discovered that no situation is really hopeless and that it is possible for us to find contentment and even happiness, whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. We urge you to try our program. It has helped many of us to find solutions that lead to serenity. So much depends on our own attitudes, and as we learn to place our problem in its true perspective, we find it loses its power to dominate our thoughts and our lives. The family situation is bound to improve as we apply the Al-Anon ideas. Without such spiritual help, living with an alcoholic is too much for us, for most of us. Our thinking becomes distorted by trying to force solutions, and we become irritable and unreasonable without knowing it. The Al-Anon program is based on the suggested 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we try little by little, one day at a time, to apply to our lives, along with our slogans in the Serenity Prayer. The loving interchange of help among members and daily reading of Al-Anon literature thus make us ready to receive the priceless gift of serenity. Al-Anon is an anonymous fellowship. Everything that is said here in the group meetings and member to member must be held in confidence. Only in this way can we feel free to say what is on our minds and in our hearts. For this is how we help one another in Al-Anon. And I'm going to turn it over to Jimmy. He's going to introduce the speaker tonight.
My name is Jimmy Dean. I'm an alcoholic, and I am your Al-Anon speaker's chauffeur for this evening. I've been on a couple of committees with your Lynette over the past couple of years, and when Olga and I were talking about this deal and discussing maybe whether or not I would know someone who might be a good Al-Anon speaker to invite to this venue. I didn't tell Lynette on the way down here. I know that introducers introduce and speakers speak. I get that. I'm just going to take about 1 minute just to tell you about the efficiency of the Al-Anon family groups, and I did not share this with Lynette. I was doing the steps right after I talked to Olga about Al-Anon speaker over in Irving, in a group in Irving, and there were three or four members of the Al-Anon family groups who were coming to that open speaker meeting every week. So the second or the third week, I got there about 15 minutes before the meeting started, and I sat down with one of the Al-Anon members, and I said, I need Beverly B. telephone number from Louisville. And she said, I know Beverly, I don't have that number, but I bet I can get it for you. And I just think about that like I would with a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I throw that out there for you. You're going to get the information and you're going to get back to me. So I'm going to tell you that at 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, and that meeting was over at 9, that lady was on my cell phone, and she had Beverly B's cell phone number, home phone number, prior phone number, future phone number. And I said, Helen, if the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was 10% as efficient as the Al-Anon family groups, we would have absolutely not a care in the world. Now, what I can tell you about Lynette is I know she is a good home group member. I know that she has a sponsor, and she sponsors an Al-Anon, and I think we're in for a treat tonight. So please help me welcome Lynette from Preston, Dallas, Texas.
Thank you, Jimmy. We've talked a lot tonight. I was visiting in the car on the way down. We've said a bunch. We ought never be organized. But sometimes it's just a good idea to be able to share with each other and talk about the good members of our group and folks that are active and sponsoring and show up at their committed meetings and do the deal and work the steps. You don't mind if I take my jacket off? I'm about to burst out. Isn't it nice to be middle-aged? It's a power surge, and it's exciting, I'll tell you. So thank you very much for the opportunity to come here and talk with you a little bit about what this program has done in my life. You know, we're supposed to share what we were like and what happened and what we're like today. And I tell you, it's that moment of clarity that we get and the transformation that we get. I love to come to speaker meetings, and I love to see when somebody's home and there's a spark and we're not so serious and downtrodden and desperate and, it's pitiful people before we come in here. And so I'm always glad to come and tell you about how it worked for me. Can you hear me? Am I speaking too loud? It's hard for me to tell. Everybody in the back okay? We all right? Okay, good. So I like to start my talk with a quote from our One Day at a Time book. It's a little blue book, real popular in the L&I group. You might try it if you hadn't tested it out yet. And it's actually a quote from Tolstoy. And he says, "I sit on a man's back, choking him, making him carry me, and yet tell everybody else that I wish to ease his lot by all possible means, except by getting off his back." And that is pretty much my story. I don't know how Tolstoy knew me, but I'll tell you, that is pretty much a recap of how it worked for me. I grew up in Plano, Texas, which is a suburb of Dallas, and it was a very small community when I lived in Plano. It was about 5,000 folks, and so Future Farmers of America, and our house was fairly close to the downtown area, and I would walk downtown to Dowdy's Pharmacy and get a cherry coke or something, and really nice. Knew a lot of the members of the community. I knew the mayor, and I knew a lot of the councilmen and that kind of thing. Kind of a small town atmosphere. My dad ran for councilman, and that was a lot of fun. They had JC's had a fair every year that they would come. That was in the Piggly Wiggly parking lot, and it was a very nice place to grow up. A nice environment. I'm an only child. If you haven't had an opportunity to be an only child, I strongly recommend it. Highly recommend it. If you get to pick it on your next time out, really do. You get to be the center of the attention, and everybody dotes on you. And it was really a lovely way to grow up. My dad was a dentist, and so all of my needs were met. I mean, all of my, everything was always, I never wanted for food or clothes or any of the material things in my life ever. It was really a nice environment, middle-class environment to work, to grow up in. When my dad first started his practice, our home was in the same building as his practice, and so he worked right next door, and he would come home for lunch, and so I really got to hang out with him quite a bit, and I just adored him. I absolutely adored my dad, and we're a lot alike physically. We big belly and skinny little bitty legs, and tall and skinny arms, and very similar sense of humor. And you know how it is when you hang out with somebody a lot, you can just about finish their sentences. I got my dad. I knew what his thoughts were going to be. I understood his sense of humor, and I just loved hanging around with him. He taught me how to play the guitar, and we would sit on the couch and sing Peter, Paul, and Mary protest songs, and he had an Austin Healey, and I would go in the garage with him and, help him on work on the Austin Healey and hold the flashlight, be a big help like that, and it was just really a good life, and I enjoyed it so much, and my mom was real good. I always forget to say something about my mom, so I'm going to try to work that in there. She just really doted on me. She would cook my favorite meals, and she sewed clothes for me, and she really went to a lot of effort to make my life very pleasant. I, on the other hand, wasn't as good a daughter to her because I only had eyes for my dad. I just, everything, was daddy's little girl, and I was all about him. And so as alcoholism began to take a foothold in our home, I didn't like it at all. I didn't like it one little bit. I was real attached to my dad, and I felt like there was this umbilical cord that we were, attached, and we were as one, and we were connected, and, we had this, from the gut to the head, every level that you can be connected to another human being, I really felt that way with my dad. Whether it was appropriate or not, I felt it. I felt connected to this guy. And so, for example, at night, if we would sit down to play the guitar, and he would start drinking that scotch, I felt there would be like this glass wall that would come down between us, and I couldn't feel that connection with him when he would be, having a lot of scotch to drink. And so I began the process as a elementary school kid. Can I get you a glass of water? He liked buttermilk. But, you know, can I get you a glass of buttermilk? Can I make you a sandwich? Can I, you know, what can I do to delay the effects that he would have with the scotch? Of course, it caused problems. The drinking caused problems within my parents' marriage, and I became the go-between. Between my parents, where I soon became the person that would go out to the garage and ask Dad to come in for dinner, and I don't know, it was like there was a radio station, and my mom was always just slightly off tune with him. She didn't have the same connection with him. She didn't know the right timing. She didn't know the right words. She just didn't seem to have. You know, it was always static when she would try to communicate with him. I'm sure, you know, a lot of that has to do with resentment and anger, you know, all the stuff that goes on in alcoholism and marriages. And so I just kind of became the person that would seem to have some effect on whether or not he would come in for dinner or whatever the chore was at the time. And that was not a good lesson for me. It appeared that I could make him come in for dinner when she couldn't. And that was a power deal. That became a big power deal for me, of me thinking that I had power over another alcoholic. And, boy, that didn't translate well as I got to be an adult at all. So I was real attached to him and just really adored him and just hated when he would have a lot to drink. So the signs of alcoholism, you know, it is a progressive disease, and it progressed, and there were very concrete, clear signs that the disease was progressing in our home. Addison was the place where you could buy booze. Plano was dry at the time, and so I would get in the car with them in the summer, and we would go off to Addison to get the alcohol. And one time, it was, I don't know, we were living in, West Plano at the time. Sorry, I don't do that very well. That's a good thing we got here, I'll tell you. We're on our way out to Addison to buy the booze, and this was in the summertime. It was hot, and literally it was 5 miles, 7 miles, some very short distance. And so on the way out to the booze store, my dad stopped the car. I was maybe in junior high at this time, and he lifted the trunk and went around to the back and took a drink of, it was vodka or something that was in the trunk at the time, and I thought, oh, that is so, man, it must have been 140 degrees, you know, in the middle of summer in the trunk. And I thought, wow, that's really odd. I just don't understand that, because at the time, you could get a mixed drink. Remember, you used to get a mixed drink at the store. It was okay to drive around. You know, we had open container laws in Texas at the time. And so I thought, man, that's just not very far away for us to get to the liquor store. How odd. My parents had, my parents had bought a cabin up at Lake Texoma, and there were many, I won't say many, but there were maybe 15 people from Plano that had a cabin up at Lake Texoma, and so it became this whole great big Plano Navy that we had up there. We would water ski and fish and have fish fries and, you know, a lot of parties at all the weekends, and it was a big time for me. I had such a good time. That was such a great opportunity. We had motorcycles and did all kinds of great stuff. It was a wonderful place for a teenager to be, and I thoroughly enjoyed my days up there. And, you know, we would literally stay on the skis for an hour at a time, and, you know, Dad didn't care. He was in the boat drinking. It didn't make any difference if he was moving in the boat or not, so he let us just go and go and go and go and go, and it was one. Built pyramids, and it was just a great time. Really enjoyed that. But my mom began to think that, gee, he doesn't want to come home Sunday nights till very late at night. She's got school the next day, and it's dangerous to get in the car with him, and so we began taking two cars up there. And so since my dad was a dentist, when we would come back to the house, of course, the phone would be ringing off the wall, and, you know, oh my God, my tooth blowing up, and where is he? And whether he was home or not, the lying began, because he would be too drunk if he was at home, or, you know, he just wasn't there and still at the lake drinking, and we really began the whole cover-up process. In fact, I used to fill in a little bit at the office, and my mom used to joke a little bit about how patients would call in and say, well, I would like the 9 a.m. appointments, so, because I want the doctor to be really fresh. And we'd be thinking, shut right. Boy, you're going to get something fresh. You know, because he went sober till the afternoon, of course. And so I can just recommend, if you're going to make an appointment with your physician, do it in the afternoon. It's really a better fact. And you probably already know that, right? So, you know, the covering up was going on. And you know, it was what we presented to the outside of the world. I mean, literally, when I was in high school, we would hold hands as a family walking up to my grandmother's house. And we presented this connected, happy family unit that had nothing to do. I was reluctant to invite my friends over to the house because I didn't know what I would find there. And I was one of those kids that I would literally wait at the front door for my dad to come home and walk in the door and see what kind of day we were going to have. Everything. I mean, the whole demeanor of the house was, for me, was based on what kind of mood is he in, what kind of attitude is he in, are we going to get to sit down and play the game, you know, what kind of thing are we going to have, and look to him for everything, to see what kind of day I was going to have. And that carried me to the gates of insanity and hell, too. I'll tell you, I learned that early on. So we had this family unit that we presented that wasn't the truth, and, you know, life was still really good for me, though. I mean, even though he was drinking a lot at night, he never missed work. I mean, never, never missed work. And still was the center of attention, and I was in drill team, and they would always come to the football games, and they supported me and everything, and were good parents to me, very, very good parents to me. And so I really had a high interest in keeping up the family unit with what we had going. And I always believed that he could quit drinking if he wanted to. Now, when somebody is your God and they say, I can quit drinking if I want to, I'm buying into it. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker. And I truly believe that at a gut, DNA, bone level, that he could stop drinking if he wanted to. When I was 16, I got a Ford Fairlane 500. It was four on the floor. And so to earn money for gas, I would fill in for the receptionist at the front of my dad's office, or vacuumed his office, did several different chores up there to earn money for gas, which was 19 cents, right? Haven't seen that in a while, have we? And so one Sunday afternoon, I bebopped over there, and, oh, one more thing I forgot to tell you. Sometimes when I would fill in for my dad in the office, I would hear him talking about me, and he would be saying things like, sounded like to me, Lynette's going to the Palestinian area next week, and she's going to resolve that little issue that they have over there, and then the week after that, she's going to Africa and resolve the AIDS crisis that they have over there, and then after that, she's taking that little trip to Mars, and she's going to, you know, see what the source of life is on Mars. And, you know, and I tell you all, I am a C student. A C student all the way. I'm not a, you know, I'm not scientific. I'm not good at math. This is not my area of genius. And I can remember sitting at the kitchen table, and I didn't understand the math problems, and my daddy got out that slide rule. Got the slide rule, and, you know, I would just be crying and not understanding, and it was just horrible. But anyway, I would hear him talking about me there with the whoever patient was in the chair with the cotton in the mouth, and yeah, I really thought, oh my goodness, I am never ever going to be able to live up to what he thinks I am. I am not those things. I am not those things at all. And so I felt very pressured, and like I was running from behind to try to be the things that he thought I should be. So this whole people-pleasing thing, you know, man, I was really behind the curve and just trying to be who he wanted me to be, desperately to be who he wanted me to be. But anyway, when I turned 16, I got this car. One Sunday afternoon, I'd be bopped over there to vacuum the office, and there was my dad and his receptionist doing the thing that sometimes adults will do on Sundays afternoons, and you know, he was just caught red-handed, just flat out caught red-handed, and I was upset, and I didn't know what to do with this information. So I got back in the car, and I was driving around the back roads of Plano, and you know, I knew inside me, again, that I have a pretty good gig at home, and I really don't want to mess this up, and should I tell my mom, should I not tell my mom what I've witnessed here, you know, what should I do with this deal? So I finally decided to go home and wait for him to come home, and let's just see what he has to say about it. And so I got home and waited on him, and he came in, and we sat down to dinner, and nothing was ever said, ever, about, you know, about what had taken place and what was going on. And, I mean, it was months and months and months later. And I just think that's so common in an alcoholic home that, you know, we just shove it under the rug. We're not going to talk about it. We're not going to look at it. We're in, you know, that just didn't happen, right? We don't say anything about it. It didn't happen. So, but I altered that day. I changed that day. And I went from,
took a black and white person. I went from this believing everything that he ever told me, that I was the light of his life, that, you know, that I was a wonderful person and that he loved me, to his life is a sham, just like his marriage is a sham, what he felt about me is a sham, everything's a sham, and I was ready to get out of the house, ready to go, right now, ready to leave the house. So when it became time for me to go to college, a bunch of my friends were going to UT, and I decided that I wanted to go to Tech because it was far away. Nobody else was going there. I could start out my life. So here was my first geographic cure, okay, at 18, starting out at UT. And it turned out 2 weeks ago, it was a really good decision for me to go to Texas Tech. Less than it, do my football game. That's a pretty good game. So anyway, I went up to Texas Tech and had a great time. Love Lubbock. I mean, just a great school, great town. Town's completely supportive of the college. It was just a really good experience for me. I pledged a sorority. Loved that whole thing. Still in contact with my sorority sisters. Loved that whole experience. I was also running track for Texas Tech, and so loved doing the jockey thing and, you know, being with those jockette type girls that, you know, really enjoy doing that. And I could do both roles. I mean, I find that many of us in the LMI program can be whoever you want me to be. When I was in Oakland, it's a section of Dallas not too long ago, I found this pin when I was walking on the street, and I really wished I'd bought it, but it said, codependent if you want me to be. Isn't that a stitch? Oh, I just love that. I think that's really funny. Anyway, so loved Tech, you know, enjoyed it, had a great first year, and except for that scholastic probation part, that wasn't nearly as fun, but I did fly through and, you know, brought my grades up enough to stay in everything I was involved with and to go back the next year, which I was really glad for. Man, it's a big carrot to go to college, you know, to keep your grades up, so I did, and managed to do that. My second year, I found this blonde-haired, blue-eyed, charming young cowboy. Oh, my goodness. I mean, he was just so interesting and so different from the kids that I had met in high school in Plano. And so I really, I just a head over heels in love with this young man. However, he was a heavy drinker, and of course he would be, you know, a heavy drinker. Why else would I be attracted to him? And, you know, I found that all that stuff that I had left behind in Plato, I had just, you know, I brought me with me into Lubbock, and it was a very immature and volatile and loud and ridiculous. I don't know. I don't even know the adjective to describe this relationship, but what I do like to say about it is that we have the perfect love-hate relationship. We both loved him, and we both hated me. You know, I had that that sensation of I'm not good enough, I'm always running behind, I'm always trying to catch up, I'm always trying to be enough. You know, and I had that great big hole in my gut. I was never, never enough. There never could be enough. There couldn't be enough sex. There couldn't be enough love. There couldn't, you know, he could never say enough about me. There were no compliments that were going to be enough. I always discounted all the compliments. There just never could be enough. And since we both loved him, he loved him too, I loved him, and we both hated me, he loved me, hated me, I hated me, and it was just a bad situation from the get-go. So, I took this relationship for 3 years, 3 years at Tech, and after I was a senior in school. You know, when you date somebody for a long time, you pretty much get to know their friends, and they get to know your friends, and you know the circle, right? Everybody knows everybody. But one day, True had been working in the stockyards, and he came home from work, and he brought some cowboys home with him that I didn't know. And it was a beautiful day, like just like today, where the wind blows. It's always blowing in Lubbock. The wind was blowing, and we were just sitting around the living room and having a few beers. Nobody was drunk. It wasn't any big deal. But I don't know, the mood in the room just turned. It just turned. I don't know what caused it to turn, but it just turned. And those cowboys set down their beers and picked me up and carried me into the bedroom. And I thought, oh, this is just a power play by True. He just thinks he's being funny, and he thinks he's just trying to scare me, and, you know, it isn't any big deal. And my clothes started coming off. And I got really scared, and I was screaming, and I was getting naked. I mean, I was getting naked against my will with these guys. So, I mean, here's the guy that I've been dating for 3 years, plus three guys that I didn't know. And so, I mean, I was really in full panic, fight for my life mode. Fortunately for me, his roommate came home, and
broke up that party. And, you know, that was an awful thing to do. That was a pretty darn crappy thing to do for somebody that you date for, you know, some period of time and care for. And, but what makes this a really sick story is that I was unable to terminate that relationship after that event. I was connected. I knew what it was to be connected to that guy. And to give up on True would be to give up on me, to give up on my dad, to give up on, you know, any significant relationship that I've had in my life, and I just could not do it. So, here's what the God of my understanding did for me, and you know, this is just still remains amazing to me today. And I told you that my dad would talk to his patients about me while they were in the chair. Okay, I started in college in the business, but the math was too hard, so I moved over to arts and science and majored in advertising. And one of the guys, one of my dad's patients, happened to be in advertising, and he worked for a huge Campbell Ewald, which is this huge advertising agency that has affiliates all over the world. The president of the advertising agency in Paris, France, wanted his son to go to New York and work for the New York agency for 3 months, and he was willing to do an intern swap for 3 months, and I got to be that person. I mean, this is a miracle of unbelievable proportion. C student, not involved into the, you know, any of the advertising clubs or you know, forward thinking, or you know, I'm just not connected with that. So literally, after I took my last test at Texas Tech to graduate from school, I drove home to Dallas and unpacked my bags, to move to Paris. And literally 2 days later, after my last test, I was standing in the Orly Airport in Paris going, oh my God, how did I get here? How did I get here? And here's the other weird thing about this. Because I'm so bad at math in high school, I could take a foreign language instead of taking math, and guess what language I chose? French. Is that just amazing? And so, not that I could understand anybody, but I could read the, you know, where's the toilet? So I had some basis of the language, because of course I made C in French as well. But, you know, at least I had some basis of the language and could get around just a little bit and have some understanding. Although, you know, if you've ever learned a foreign language, they speak it so fast compared to what you learn in the classroom. But at least I could read some of it and get by. And it was a wonderful experience. And so I lived in France for several months, and it was just a great experience. And again, I made lifelong friends. My roommate from over there has sent her kids over to come and see America and visit with us. Her sister came to our wedding, and I mean, just really, it's been a great experience. And what a broadening experience for me. Oh my goodness, just it was so terrific. You know, from little bitty Plano and little bitty Lubbock to go and live in an international city like that. I mean, I really, I was a very not savvy person about the world, and yet I was safe and protected and, you know, good. It was good. It was good. It was wonderful. And so I really enjoyed that. After I was there for about 3 months, my parents said, well, since you're over there, I guess we should come over and let's take a look at Europe. And so, great, come on by. And so they flew over. They flew over, and the very first night that they got there, my mother said, your father has something to tell you. And so I said, okay, what's up? And he said, well, we're going to get a divorce. And, you know, my first thought was, interesting timing, you know, because, of course, I've been knowing about the sham of their marriage for quite some time. And so I'm not sure what happened on their end to cause the failure of the marriage, but my mother was so furious. She was so angry. So either she had found out about what was going on with him and whoever her was at the time, you know, I don't know what the situation was, but I know is that she was mad. So we got on the train, train I guess it was, and we went to Italy, and it was, you know, there's the Statue of David. Did you get a picture of it? Fine. And march off to, you know, to the Met Coliseum, and you look at that, you know, and oh, it was just, and here I was back and forth between my parents. Are you okay? Are you okay? Trying to, you know, make some nice between them. There was no fix in that relationship. I don't, you know, that is so egotistical for me to think that I could patch up the thing that they had going. You know, there's no way I could make, oh, and my dad was just hound dog, you know, and miserable and unhappy. Oh, it was really, really a wreck. But again, I think that can only happen in alcoholic homes. I don't think people go to Europe if they're about to divorce, you know. I don't think that's a common thing to happen. So, anyway, that happened, and they went home, and I went home, and came back to Dallas and started to work for an advertising agency in Dallas, which was really, really fun. I thoroughly enjoyed working for this advertising agency. It was fun to be young and starving in advertising, and so began working there, and after I worked there for maybe a year or so, I saw this really handsome, charming, debonair print rep who sold color separation, and oh, he was just so Dallas and darling and drinking. He was my kind of guy, I'll tell you. Oh, I mean, he was, you know, at the time, that was in the 80s sometime, and you know where the tie matched the pocket square deal, you know, I mean, he was just so wow, you know, he was really very charming and very Catholic. He had a ton of cute siblings, and his parents were just so, so, so sweet, really sweet, and his dad liked taking a drink every now and then, I'll tell you, and, you know, he was just charming. And so my deal on this, instead of being the doormat that I had been before, and you know, I said, man, I am never going to do that again. And so instead of being the doormat, I became the Gestapo. And oh my goodness, I'll tell you, it was hot tongue and cold shoulder and just, you know, vicious and ugly. And this is where I really began my career in marking bottles and watering down bottles and serious manipulation and punishment. This is where I really got into my punishment phase. And oh, that poor kid, I'll tell you, I punished him for being an alcoholic. I punished him for every drink that he ever took. I punished him for loving me. I punished him for not loving me. I mean, I just punished him over and over and over. And I will tell you today that if I had to pick one of those two things, I'm picking the doormat every time. I hated who I became in that relationship. I became so vicious and so ugly and so punishing. And I mean, and you know, if you practice something long enough, you get really good at punishing. Really, really good at it. And I never, never, never want to go back to that. And so what you taught me is that contempt for the disease of alcoholism does not cure it. It doesn't cure it. And I just did not get that. I really thought if I made him see the light, made him understand my words, had that influence over him like I had over my dad when I was a third grader, that I could make him stop drinking. You know, you will obey me kind of thing. And he was just such a nice guy. He would raise up in the morning, he'd raise up on an elbow and say, won't you ever think about marrying me? No. I mean, I was ugly, 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 ugly. Really, I never want to go back to that again. That was horrible, horrible, horrible. And as long as I'm blaming somebody else for my behavior, there is no possibility of recovery for me. I justified every bit of that was, well, if you hadn't been drinking, I wouldn't have to be like this. And there was never any hope of recovery for me as long as I was stuck in that mode. And so, dang, would you look at the time? Being in alcoholism, I love this analogy. Growing up in alcoholism is like being out on the ocean. And sometimes it's calm, and sometimes, you know, it gets pretty stormy and pretty wavy and pretty scary and tidal and very vicious. And so we start looking around for things that are going to help us. And so maybe we'll pick up some water wings, or we'll pick up some flippers, or we'll pick up some scuba gear, and we'll pick up masks and fins and all those things, you know. And those may help us at the time in the midst of disease to get by. But then we find our way to the shore, and we walk out on shore, and here I am walking in town with masks and snorkel and fins and all this gear on that I don't need anymore, that are not helpful to me anymore. And so that's why I come into this program, to get rid of that stuff that I is questionable that I ever needed it, and I darn sure don't need it today. And so that's why I come in here, to cover, undiscover, and discard the things that I don't need, that I may have picked up in the disease of alcoholism, that are not helpful to me today, not helpful to me at all. So let me just pick up what was going on with my dad at that time. He married his receptionist. Her name was Connie. And Connie was kind of his 40s fling kind of gal. She was just big and dramatic, and everything was a big deal, and just a pretty amazing gal. I mean, she was a lot of fun, and, you know, big laugher and big talker, and kind of an interesting out there kind of gal. And I'll just tell you one story about Connie that I like to tell about her, because it's pretty funny and very descriptive of Connie. We had a tragedy happen in my family. My great uncle, I'm not sure what's happened to Aunt Ethel. She, I don't know, she had some kind of dementia, but she was a big woman, and for a young person's eyes, a scary woman. She had a big old wart here, and it just kind of, she scared me. Annette will scare me, but it was tragic what happened to her. He could no longer take care of her, and so he hit her in the forehead with a pinball hammer and then shot himself. So, you know, very terrible family tragedy. But Connie's response to that is that she started sleeping in a football helmet. Yeah, she was afraid that my dad thought this might be a solution, you know, for their marital problems, and so she started sleeping in this football. I mean, everything was such a big deal with Connie. Big deal. I mean, Connie ruled the roost in her house. She really did. Connie had all the power in that house. And after they'd been married for a couple of years, she decided that what they needed in their marriage was 10 days with a couple of two-day follow-ups. Y'all remember that slogan from Schick or, you know, one of those places in the 80s when they were accepting insurance in those dry-out tanks. And so one Christmas we went down to, I really don't know what it was, Schick or whatever, I hate to misrepresent, but one of those drying out places. And their solution for the disease of alcoholism is that they would shoot my dad up with an abuser or whatever drug it was, and he would drink 8 tumblers of scotch. And then he would puke 8 tumblers of scotch, and that's how they would fix the disease of alcoholism. Yeah, I mean, they literally put him in a shower curtain and he would just, you know, puke and puke and puke and puke and puke. Some kind of Pavlov something, I don't know what they had going there, but that, yeah, I don't know what that was. So, you know, I tell you, I remember thinking, finally, somebody has got the power over him to make him mind and make him stop drinking. He didn't go down there to stop drinking. He went down there to get back in good graces with Connie. He had no intention of stopping drinking. You know, he was only wanting to get back with Connie. And so it didn't work. And I remember that as a pretty sad period in my life because I really thought, oh, thank goodness, somebody has found a way to make him stop drinking. And, of course, it didn't work. It didn't take. So when they got back to Plano, Connie accused my dad of trying to electrocute her children, and she moved to Houston. And that was the last we saw of Connie. But I'll tell you, during the process of him getting a divorce with Connie, he did not want the divorce. He really cared for Connie and was very sad about that, but, you know, recognized that he couldn't live with Connie and make that all work out. Or he couldn't drink and live with Connie. You know, maybe that was the story. I don't know. But he said that he wanted to come live with me for the period of time while this divorce was going through. And I said, okay, now I've got the power. If you don't drink in my home, then you can come and live with me. And I will tell you, that is the worst 6 months I ever spent with my dad. You know, he was white-knuckling this divorce that he did not want, and it was white-knuckling sobriety, and it was horrible. He was the most morose, depressed, pitiful human being that I have ever, and I, you know, I've seen him drunk, but never, never as pitiful as he was during this period of time. And y'all, I was completely and totally baffled by this. I have finally gotten my way. My dad is not drinking. This should be the most joyous time that we have ever spent together. Why is this not working? I mean, I just didn't get that. I just did not understand. And of course, you know, it takes the 12 steps to cure the disease of alcoholism. And he, I mean, it just, you know, after 6 months, I said, my God, let's go get a drink. I mean, I really couldn't take it anymore. Woo, that was just awful. So, he moved out, went back to Farmersville. They had a little place that they were building out there. That he, I say building, he was working on out there, and it was pretty slow and not working very fast. But I had an incident where I got a call from his then receptionist at the time, and it was a Monday morning about 10 o'clock, and it was storming in the area, and the receptionist called and said, your dad's not here, do you know where he is? And I said, no, isn't he at work? Because I'm going to tell y'all, he never, never, never missed work. He just did not miss work. And I think that was that deal of, I'm a good provider. I'm still working, so therefore I must not be an alcoholic. I mean, I really felt that he felt that strongly about it. And so when he wouldn't work at 10 o'clock, I was really afraid. He'd been working on the roof that weekend, and so I got in my car, and I drove north on Highway 78, which is a little two-lane highway, headed up to Farmersville, and it was storming, and the rain was, you know, coming down on my windshield, and I was passing on uphill lanes on the left-hand side of the road. I mean, I was really pedal to the metal, going fast. And I know that if I had died that day and killed somebody else, on my death certificate, it would have said crushed chest or whatever the injury would have been, but it would have been from the disease of alcoholism. I had so terrorized myself, you know, I just knew that I was going to drive into the yard and he would be laying on the ground from having fallen off the roof because he'd been drunk, and rain would be pitter-pattering on his eyeballs. I mean, you know, this vivid imagery, you know, that we carry. Everybody in Al-Anon should be a screenwriter, really. I mean, we just have the most incredible imaginations about what's gone wrong. And the power had gone out. He was just fine. The alarm didn't wake him up, so he didn't make, you know, there was no big deal. And by the time I got there, I was snotty everywhere, you know, just a blithering mess and completely terrified. He wasn't responsible for that. He had no idea that I had been called and, you know, and said, where are you? So, I think there are probably many instances out there of people dying that don't have the disease of alcoholism, that sure live in it and live with the effects of that. Some period of time after that event, Dad married his hygienist. And so Carolyn was a lovely person, lovely, charming person. I adore Carolyn. Carolyn, you know, Dad at this time was drinking. He would start in the car. He loved that hot booze. For some reason, that was just his deal. And so 5 o'clock in the afternoon, he'd get off work, and he would drink all the way home and drink till 3 o'clock in the morning. He'd sleep for a few hours, get up, work, start drinking at 5 o'clock. You know the rule. You know how it goes. And so I came to a point in my life where I just couldn't watch that anymore. You know, I loved him. I loved him so. And to watch him slowly dying like that, it's just so painful. It's just so painful to watch that. It's really awful. So anyway, he married Carolyn, and she was able to be so kind to him in a period of time where he was pretty messy. He was a pretty messy guy. You know how sometimes an alcoholic will want to make their point, and they will follow you everywhere in the house to make the point? You know, they're just following you from room to room. Carolyn would just get in the bed and pull the covers over her head, you know, say, I'm going to bed, honey, I love you, and, you know, and he would just be left making his point for whatever reason. I mean, he was just, you know, relentless with that. Anyway, she was very, very gracious to him, and I'm so, so glad that she had him and he had her at this period of time in his life. He had bought a Mary Miler, which is this, it's kind of a van that converts into a, y'all know what a Mary Miler is? It's a small kind of, I don't know, suburban-looking thing that can, okay, so that, you know, like the back seat converts into a bed, the front seat converts into the stove, and overhead it converts into, you know, something, I don't know. There's a shower in there somewhere. Anyway, Carolyn got in this car with my dad, this Mary Miler, and they took a trip, drove up into New York, and to see Andrew Wise Museum, and my dad has a sister that lives in New Jersey, and they did this whole big trip, and I just can't imagine the horrors of, you know, when you go on vacation, that means you don't have to stop drinking from 9 to 5. You can drink around the clock, right? That's what's so fun about a vacation. And so she got in this van with him, and oh my goodness, what a terror that must have been. When they got back, they both had caught colds, and my dad had called and said, you know, it's your birthday, you want to get together, I got a little present for you. Okay. So I met him up at the Black Eyed Pea in Addison, and when I pulled up, he was sitting in the parking lot, and he was drinking that hot booze in the car and chasing it down with some codeine cough syrup. And we went into the, well, you know, he's a doctor, he can prescribe those things, isn't it handy? So we went into the Black Eyed Pea in Addison, and he didn't look good. His color wasn't good, and it just looked like more than a cold. And he started telling me about the trip, and we were just having ice tea. It wasn't like he was having a lot to drink at this particular point, I guess because he had it in the car. And he started telling me about the trip and about the Andrew Wise Museum. And while he was talking to me, he was throwing up a little bit and swallowing it. And he kept talking a little bit faster and a little bit faster about the trip. Like if he convinced me that he had had a good time on the trip, he would have had a good time on the trip. You know what I'm talking about? That just kind of desperation. And he finally kind of slowed down and said, you know, I don't feel very good. Maybe we can get together tomorrow. And I said, well, gee, that's a good idea. And so I paid for our iced teas and he left. And that is the very first time I had any inkling whatsoever that he could not beat this disease. I for so long, against so many concrete examples that he wasn't going to be able to be, I mean, I just really didn't get it until that very night, and he looked so bad. The next day, he was offloading a washer or dryer or something off the back end of the truck into a ravine behind where his farm was in Farmersville, and he died. And that was the last time I saw him, was at the Black Eyed Pea, and, you know, I just think that there's this line that God says, that's enough. That is enough. You don't have to live like that anymore. And while I wish that we could have walked this program together, I wish we could have found recovery together, my dad doesn't have to drink anymore. And I didn't have to drink anymore. And I'm very, very grateful for that. And so because of working these steps and having a sponsor and going to the meetings and doing the deal that we do in here, I feel completely and totally okay with all of that. I'm not mad. I'm not unhappy. I'm not pissed off that he was an alcoholic. I'm not pissed off that I grew up in alcoholism. I am completely and totally at ease with all of that. After had the services there. My dad built the house in West Plano that we lived in and designed all of it and built it. It was a lovely home, lovely, lovely home. And so all the family came down. We had the services there in the home that he built. And it just so happened, my mother, remember my mother? How was she yet? My mother, my lovely mother. She had remarried, married this wonderful man. Oh, my goodness, he's a great guy. He treats me like a queen. He's got three daughters, and I am just another one of the daughters, equal in everything. He's a great, great guy. And he's not alcoholic. How did she marry somebody that's not alcoholic? I mean, really, I don't get that. But she didn't. They were in Colorado, and you know how beautiful Colorado is in the summer. And so they were at a dew ranch up in Colorado, and so I called her and asked her if I could come and spend a couple of days up there, and she said, of course. And so I went up there, and as I was walking through some of the mountains in Colorado, I had that moment of clarity that we talk about in here. And I saw that I had never, ever, not once, dated somebody that wasn't alcoholic, ever. And I had to admit to myself that, gee, not every male on the planet is alcoholic. So it must not be the big E's. It must have something to do with the big R. And boy, I didn't like to see that. I didn't like to see it at all. And I saw some of my behavior in these relationships and how I had been. And so when I came back to Dallas, I called up Carolyn and asked her if she wanted to go to a meeting. And on September 15th, of 1986, I came to the Preston Group, and I have been coming very faithfully ever since. And I got a sponsor, and I started to work the steps, and we started to go to conferences and started to get involved in service work. And I took, you know, some inventory that I have to tell you, that denial that was so strong in me to not see that my dad couldn't beat alcoholism worked the same with my defects of character. I really, when I started to take that fourth step, I would never have believed those defects of character if I had not set them down on paper myself. And even when I was going through my fifth step, you know, my sponsor said, well, that's not really an asset. You really wouldn't put that in the asset column. And so, and talk about some of those things and how helping others is not a good thing, you know. Yes, of course, it's a good thing to help others in some way, but to help them, you know, you have to stop drinking so that I'll be happy isn't helping others. And I didn't see that for the longest time. It really took a very thorough and searching inventory for me to see that. And so I got through that fourth step, and, you know, I got to experience that whole pink cloud thing as I got into the fifth step and how wonderful it was. And I just felt like I belonged. You know, man, I had come here, and now I'm a part of this deal because I've had the courage to go through and make it through the fourth step and go through this fifth step. And, you know, wow, to make the man scared, to make those amends, you know, really terrified. I mean, that first amend I made was to a company that I had worked for, and I called up nobody that I, when I was working there was there anymore, so I called the president of the company. I said, Mr. Wainwright, can I please have an appointment with you? I mean, I was really, really scared, and made the amend to the guy, and I'll tell you, if I see him now, he will run across the room to shake my hand. I'm sure it was his first experience with somebody in a 12-step program, and he was really baffled. Why would you be handing me a check when it's been 12 years since you've worked at this company? You know, but I did, and it's so nice that I don't have to duck anybody that's on my list. I am free from ducking people. I'm free from the manipulations that I caused and the harm that I caused. And I'll tell you, I called that little Irish Catholic up right away and said, I was wrong. All those vicious and mean things that I said about you were true about me and not about you. And I was wrong. And I'm very, very sorry for hurting your feelings. And I never will do that again. I'll tell you, he used to call about every 5 years or so, just the nicest young man. And he's married now. He's got a couple kids who, of course, are drug addicts. And he's walking the walk, isn't he? And so he called, I don't know, 2 years ago, something like that. And he said, did you know I had an accident? And I said, no. And he had been doing some renovations on his house, and it was on the stairway, and he fell and broke his neck, and he's paralyzed from the waist down. And y'all, this was that kid that was in, you know, the matching tie and the matching pocket handkerchief and, you know, perfectly shined shoes and all that, and now he's tied in a wheelchair, and it's just so sad what this disease does. It's so, the losses that we experience in this disease are so awful. And so I really only bring that up to just to remember about what our primary purpose is in here, to reach out to those who are still suffering in active alcoholism and to reach out to those folks that are so miserable and so pitiful that you know, that don't have the answer, that don't get it, that are looking and seeking the opportunities that we had when we came into the program. And I just want to finish with a little ditty that was written by Sam Shoemaker, who was instrumental in the first days of AA, and many of you probably already know this, but it's called I Stand By the Door, and it goes like this. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in or stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It's the door through which men walk when they find God. There's no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside, and they, just as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is a wall where a door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched, groping hands, knowing there must be a door, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door somewhere, and yet they can't find it. So I stand by the door. Thank you very much.